The United States has been shocked from east to west and north to south. I don't think there is a state or a city, a village or a hamlet across this country that doesn't realize by now, this autumn of 1979, that the collapse of the dollar is imminent, and that what we're beginning to see is a little bit more serious than just the rise of prices from grocery store to grocery store, or perhaps the frustrating rise of the cost of gasoline. Up in Wisconsin Dells, I stopped by a Texaco station to fill up with fuel. I got out and asked the man to fill up with fuel, looked at the price on the fuel register, and actually I couldn't tell what it was because there was a sign blotting out the normal area where the price is registered there, said that we are now pricing our fuel in half gallons. So I asked him what the price was and then looked at the cash I had in my pockets and realized I couldn't purchase a full tank of gasoline and wound up with $5 worth, and that bought me something like 4 1/2 gallons of fuel. So we're becoming used to the fact that fuel is costing over a dollar a gallon, but it's a whole lot more serious than that, and it's come to the point now that the average American, as he is called, is even considering investing in this unusual commodity called gold. And we have seen the price of gold go up and up and up over the past few years, and finally it peaked out last week at about $450 an ounce, at least for a few hours. And we think that gold is becoming more valuable. And actually, gold is no more valuable per ounce today than it was 10 years ago. When 35 U.S. dollars would buy an ounce of gold, it's not that gold is becoming so much more valuable. It's not that people suddenly have discovered that gold has value, that it has worth, that it's worth more today. It's just simply that the value of the dollar has plummeted so that it costs a great deal more in terms of United States dollars to purchase a simple ounce of gold. No, the explosion of the price of gold, the prime interest rates in the United States now being over 13.5%, the energy crunch, which is not only causing gasoline prices to rise in the United States, but actually is threatening the existence of entire national economies abroad. We've seen gasoline go over a dollar a gallon here, which is shocking to us, but actually it's been well over $2 a gallon in Europe and other areas around the world. In some little, relatively little known areas of the world, it's even up over $5 and $6 per gallon right now. And so in preparation for the Feast of Tabernacles next year, Mr. Armstrong is beginning to feel that we may need to add 2 or 3 or 4 more sites because we fully expect the price of gas to go to $1.50 a gallon and eventually $2 a gallon, and eventually we'll be paying exactly what they are in Europe, over $2 a gallon, maybe before the Feast of Tabernacles next year. And when that kind of situation develops, the president may very well invoke the powers of gas rationing in the country. So it is becoming a problem that every individual across this country recognizes. The threat of war is also imminent. We went out to make the world safe for democracy in World War I. We repeated that in World War II. And why on earth the government at that time didn't simply tell the rest of the world to disarm? I don't know. We can't do it now. Secretary Kissinger just recently said that it has come to the point that our previous plan for defense, stalemate of the military situation with the Soviet Union, called our Mutually Assured Destruction Program, or MAD, MAD for short, is actually mad. It is actually an insane policy that no longer is valid. And we have already informed the nations of Europe that it's going to be impossible for them, unrealistic for them, any longer to look to the United States for protection from the Soviet Union or even from other nations, I suppose, within Europe from time to time, depending on how political alliances change and the balance of power changes. But the threat of war is ever present. Mr. Armstrong will be going to China in October or November of this year for a very important series of meetings, a very important trip. But at the very time he's in China, China may literally be at war again in Southeast Asia, once more trying to teach the nation that we have thought of as North Vietnam, the Vietnamese, a lesson about their border disputes. Pakistan has now startled the world by announcing that it has the capability to create atomic weapons, and very proudly has stated the fact that they are now the first Islamic country with the atomic bomb. Will they use it in their long-standing border disputes with the country of India? Will they at some point in the future attempt to settle the differences and to somehow redress the embarrassment that the Pakistani government suffered in its defeat in the hands of the Indians just a few years ago, perhaps? But this world is now seeing the proliferation in what we called at one time virtually third world countries, and felt that those countries would always be incapable of developing the major weapons that the major nations have. But now we see the proliferation of atomic weapons, even printing some of the basic informations about how to develop a hydrogen bomb in some of our recent literature. I think it was in a Newsweek or U.S. News magazine here not too long ago. Africa is still aflame, even though three of the most barbaric despots perhaps in the history of the world have just recently been removed from government in some of the black nations in the central belt of Africa. Nevertheless, border disputes, tribal difficulties, and differences threaten the possibility of the outbreak of war day in and day out across that heavily populated section of Central Africa. The Middle East is a tinderbox, in spite of what President Carter and the leaders of Israel and Egypt have done. The Middle East still remains a very troubled spot. And an important magazine in Germany recently made the following statement, Die Welt, which means simply the world, but it is an influential magazine and a very worthwhile magazine in Europe, very widely read. In fact, we even take a copy of it here in our own news bureau in Pasadena. Gene Hogberg reads German and translates those articles, I guess. Someone does anyway, but there's a great deal of information about what is going on in Europe and the world, and they say that the Middle East is still a tinderbox, and in fact, the issue between the Arab nations and the nation of Israel may very well yet prove to be the trigger for World War III. And so in spite of all that has been done, in spite of the United Nations, which really is a failure of a grand effort, which has already been recognized as the defeat of a grand ideal, and has no real power, no real influence, is unable to establish or to bring world peace, in spite of all that has been done since World War II, now even national magazines are hazarding the statement that we may very well be on the brink of World War III right now. And so this world is in confusion, and people the world over are beginning to wonder, what on earth does the future hold? Mankind the world over is perplexed. A whole lot more so. There's a great deal more unrest in the world today, and even across this wealthy nation of ours, than there was last year at this time during the Feast of Tabernacles. But over the past year, and past year and a half, the church has also been shocked by the realities of living in the end of the age. We've seen the departure of Ted Armstrong and a number of ministers in the church. We have been hit by the state of California with a monumental lawsuit involving even the establishment of a receiver in on our own grounds, in our own buildings, with armed state troopers. And immediately following that catastrophe and eventually the removal, bodily anyway, of the presence of the receiver from the Ambassador College and Worldwide Church of God grounds, we went into a cash flow crisis. And that cash flow crisis affected every facet of the work. It certainly affected us in the festival office, because there was a period of time when the receivership was still in office on our grounds, but he literally refused to allow us to prepare for the Feast of Tabernacles. He took office, if you can call it that, or established himself on our grounds about the 4th of January this past winter, and that was the very week, or just preceded the very week, all of our housing officers, all of the individuals going out to sell advertising, to sponsor the brochure, so that we don't have to pay for that out of festival funds that all of you send in, but we can still give it away free, were to go out to the various festival sites. But he stopped all travel, wouldn't let us go, and continued to put it off, not allowing us to go about our work for the festival all the time that he was there on the grounds. And then the cash flow crisis hit after that, and we had to postpone again, simply for lack of funds, until the very last minute, I guess you could say, in preparation for this Feast of Tabernacles. And as I mentioned, the final brochure or two came off the printing presses in Dallas about 2 or maybe 3 days at the most before this festival began. So the church has been shocked awake by the realities of living in the end of the age. Well, brethren, how are you? What about your family? What about your mind, your attitude, your outlook, as we heard about in the sermonette? How are you coping in this time of worldwide and international confusion, and this time of increasing persecution upon the worldwide Church of God? Let's turn back in 2 Thessalonians to a scripture. I want to read two scriptures here, actually, that have to do with our day and our age and our time. Let's begin in verse 2. Where it says that you be not soon shaken in mind or be troubled, because we're going to live through times all around us, everything from pestilence and disease epidemics to rabid animal attacks. Perhaps that kind of thing is even beginning in Los Angeles now, with the kind of outbreak of forest fires that denuded the mountains and the hillsides around the Los Angeles basin area, and now they're expecting, with the winter rains, perhaps huge mudslides and maybe even floods as a result through certain parts of the city of Los Angeles. Maybe we're beginning that era, that time of great tribulation at the present time. But God says, be not soon shaken or troubled by all the problems and difficulties that you may face, because the day of Christ. And that's referring to the end of the age. That's referring to this time in which we live now, this time in which Mr. Armstrong emphasized the importance of this Feast of Tabernacles in 1979, saying that maybe for us, for you, for me, for all of us keeping the Feast of Tabernacles worldwide, that it may very well be the most important and the most significant Feast of Tabernacles in 1900 years. You may think, perhaps, well, Mr. Armstrong is trying to get us stirred up for the feast, or he just wants us to get our minds on the feast, and is it really that important? Is it really that significant? And could it be, even, with only comparatively a handful of people observing it, if you include all 60 festival sites around the world, even if you include all 100,000-plus of God's people across the face of the earth, that doesn't make a dent in the world's population, does it? Do you believe, Mr. Armstrong, it could possibly be right that this may be the most significant festival since Christ? Is it possible with only 100,000 people? Well, we'll see before we're through today. But it is. And he didn't begin thinking about the importance of this year's festival just within the past 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, about the time he sent out the letter, even encouraging us to fast and to pray in preparation for the feast. But he began thinking about it all the way back in June, just after the day of Pentecost, when he wrote the articles for this magazine. We have to produce them, or he has to write them, and many things have to be written that early, so that we can get them in the national signatures within the brochure. And so Mr. Armstrong wrote the statement inside the first page, where he says that this year's festival may prove to be the most important so far in history, all the way back last summer in June. So his mind has been on the significance of this Feast of Tabernacles for many months, probably about the time you were just beginning to wonder, well, where might we go for the feast this year and start to get your application in. He already felt and put that in print that this year might be the most important. Let's go on a little bit further here concerning the church. And notice, beginning in verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day, that is the return of Christ, shall not come except what? A warning to those of us in God's church. And we've already begun to see this prophecy come to pass. Because God says, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. We've already seen individuals leave the church, whether in the ministry, whether membership, maybe members of your family, maybe close friends. I've had close friends, no relatives at this point, but I've had close friends leave God's church over the past year or year and a half or 2 years, and probably so have all of you. There's probably not a local congregation across these United States that has not had one or more individuals over this period of time, as the confusion in the world, as the pressures and problems begin to press down upon us a whole lot more individually, as we begin to be dragged into the events that will lead into the tribulation at the end of the age through things as simple as the price of gasoline and the cost of food at the grocery store, and the fact that many people can't afford to transfer to festival sites this year, so even some of our colder areas up north are full again, instead of seeing them transfer to maybe some of the areas where the weather is a little bit more enjoyable, simply because they couldn't afford to do so. Well, let's notice this verse 15, because what we're concerned about for us today is not a morbid discussion of individuals who have left God's church, because the Feast of Tabernacles is to be one of rejoicing. It's to be a time of being up, of being excited, of looking ahead to what this particular festival represents. But notice what God says concerning stability, concerning strength. In verse 15, he says, Therefore, referring to the problems and the difficulties that I've already read in verses 2 and 3, at the end of the age, during the time in which we're living right now, just prior to the return of Christ, therefore, brethren, stand fast. Well, how can you do that? What key is there? At least the one key that I want to emphasize here today. What is one of the keys to standing fast, regardless of whether friends or relatives or others leave God's church, to hold on to the salvation and the eternal life that God has promised to every one of us, to hold on to that resurrection or opportunity to be in the resurrection that will usher in the time of the millennium, which this feast is picturing? God tells us to stand fast, and one of the keys, one of the foundational principles to be being able to be stable and to hold fast is this, for he simply says, hold the traditions which you have been taught. Well, brethren, if we're going to remain stable, if we hope to remain stable through these troublesome times, because we're living in times that are going to be a whole lot different than what the church has experienced up to this point, of being able to meet in large festival sites with 6, 8, 10, 12, 15,000 people, all of us with 10% of our income in our pockets when it meant something. When we could afford fine hotels and motel rooms. When we could afford better meals, perhaps some special wines, a bottle of champagne. When we could have people into our hotel rooms or take another family out to dinner and have plenty of money left over and even send in what we've always in the past called excess. Second tithe. Well, there's a whole lot less excess second tithe this year. And next year there's going to be even less as we suffer the ravages of inflation. No, we're coming into a time of disease, of floods, of earthquakes, of political turmoil, of crime, of upset, of racial violence? How can you hope to remain stable during those times and cling to the promise that God has given to you? Well, brethren, if we're going to remain stable, we must, season by season, strengthen ourselves in these annual holy days. If you're going to remain stable and be steadfast and grow and be able to fulfill your part of the commission that God has given this church during the next several months immediately following the Feast of Tabernacles, then you've got to strengthen yourself spiritually at this festival and not let it simply become something that we grow accustomed to. With a little bit more money in our pockets, meeting friends from other churches and congregations, ball games, amusements, dinners out, a bottle of wine, that sort of thing. God commands us to rejoice. But first and foremost, as Mr. Armstrong was emphasizing, even with the historic precedent, as far as this era of the church is concerned, encouraging, admonishing, instructing the church to fast, especially fast, even before the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, we've not heard that before, but we're living in different times now. And we need to be sure that spiritually we have our feet on the ground. And if we're to remain stable, we must strengthen ourselves at this feast. Because right now, the Feast of Tabernacles, wherever it is being observed, is simply the most important activity on the face of this earth. Now, God gave the nation of Israel the Feast of Tabernacles back in, well, at least traditionally, the date that we use is about 1487 B.C., a long time ago. Let's turn back to Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, and just read a statement, and you probably read this statement or ones like it anyway on the annual Sabbath day. But because of the nature of what I want to talk about today, I'd like to just read it again. Back in Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, starting in verse 34, "Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of this seventh month." Notice the term seventh month. Because when God talks about the annual holy days, or let's say as they're recorded throughout history, whenever they were observed, many times it doesn't mention the day by name. It won't say Feast of Trumpets, or it won't say always Day of Atonement, or it won't say Feast of Tabernacles. It'll say simply the seventh day, a seventh month rather, and give you a particular day of the month. And by noting which day of that seventh month, you know exactly what those people were doing by what's discussed there. So this fall festival season, the third of the seasons, completing as we picture them, the plan of God, this one in particular, representing the millennium which is to come, was to begin in the seventh month on the 15th day of the month. Well, from the 15th day, 7 days through the 21st of the month is the Feast of Tabernacles, the 22nd of the month being a separate feast, the last great day. And on the first day, verse 35, shall be an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work. In 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire. And on the eighth day, a separate annual festival, the eighth day or the last great day, is the 22nd of the month. These, in verse 37, are the feasts of God in which you shall proclaim, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations. Now, God gave the annual festival days to Israel for a reason, just as he gave them to us. I think sometimes we wonder, well, now, did those people back in the Old Testament keep? I'm not talking about the offerings here now, but I'm talking about the instruction for the annual Sabbath days apart from the offerings that God added to them after Israel had rejected certain instructions that God had given them. But did the people, the counterparts, let's say, of us in the Old Testament, the prophets and the servants of God, did they observe these annual festivals at all as we do today? What about the messages that were given during the Feast of Tabernacles in particular? Did they represent anything that you're going to hear at this feast, or have we somehow devised something new. Did Mr. Armstrong, back in 1927, when he began keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, begin to devise a purpose for the annual festivals which God's servants in the Old Testament knew nothing about? Are we the only people who have ever understood the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles? Or how far back does that understanding go? Now, God gave these festivals for a particular reason. Number one, they pointed to the true God. And apart from observing these annual festivals, as we'll see here shortly, you cannot even identify God. Apart from observing the annual festivals, you cannot separate the difference in your mind as a human being, limited as we are to 70 or 80 years of human life, physical existence, not understanding the beginning, or certainly when we're converted, understanding the end of all things, and even now with prophecy, seeing, as Paul said, through a glass darkly. But apart from these annual festivals, you can't even tell the difference God shows us between Satan and Christ. And yet any Christian church, I suppose, worthy of its salt today would deny that. And yet all you have to do is look at the confusion from one so-called Christian church to another. They all don't believe the same thing. How could they all be right? These annual festivals are one of the most important heritages of God's people in any age. One of the most important gifts that God gave us in restoring His way to this earth in this era of the church are God's annual Sabbath days, all three festival seasons. And in particular, as we're observing this, the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Feast of Tabernacles and its observance, or the lack of it, has been significant throughout history. The people in history who kept God's Feast of Tabernacles recognized the identity of God. The people who did not keep God's Feast of Tabernacles lost all knowledge. In spite of how much they had been given, in spite of the promises that were given to them, they even lost all knowledge of God. And those people, even after what God gave them here, have lost that knowledge to this day. Well, the second reason that God gave the annual holy days to His people was to reveal God's plan. Because He began here at this point, now, suddenly, to deal with a nation. In the past, it had been Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, some of the prophets and servants of God, even before that, Enoch and others. But He began now to deal with a nation, and the progressive revelation, or let's say the revelation of God's plan, was progressive throughout history. And we as a group today, because of the fact that we have the entirety of the Bible to look back on, from the first chapter of Genesis all the way through the book of Revelation, we today, because of the fact that revelation is progressive, as a group, probably understand more as to the meaning and the significance of God's annual holy days in this end age than any other similar group throughout history. We're going to take a look at a sermon that was given during this Feast of Tabernacles just a little bit later here this morning. But I want you to notice, before we get into that, one of the most tragic decisions that has ever been made since the creation of mankind. The only decision, the only error made by any individual that would even begin to compare to the significance of what we're going to read back in 1 Kings, the 12th chapter, would have been the decision of Adam to reject God's way right in the beginning. But we're going to see here an entire nation, the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom by this time, because remember, God allowed the division, actually caused the division of the nation of Israel into the two areas, the northern kingdom, known as Israel, the area of Samaria, the southern kingdom known as Judah. And that occurred at this period of time, but of course the people in those days went to the city of Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So as soon as these nations were divided, certainly at least by the autumn, the issue of what to do relative to the observance of the Feast of Tabernacles became a problem. At least it became a problem to the king at that time, Jeroboam. And so in 1 Kings, the 12th chapter, he simply says in verse 28, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem." Now that was an out-and-out lie to start with. Because, of course, what he was going to do was undermine the importance for the Feast of Tabernacles, God's annual holy days. He didn't see the significance, and he thought, well, if I allow the people to go to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, they'll ally themselves with the southern kingdom, maybe even kick me off my throne and take my life. So I've got to keep my people up north from going down south to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And that's what he's preparing to do. It's the most tragic decision, certainly in the history of the nation of Israel. They never recovered from it. What Jeroboam is about to do here, for all the wrong reasons, in beginning to look to the physical problems and physical difficulties instead of looking to God for the solution and trusting in Him, is the most tragic decision involving the lives and the futures of millions of individuals for thousands of years. Now, this decision was made in the period of time we're talking about here is about 950 B.C., after the death of Solomon. Or not after the death of Solomon, but at the time of the division. Yes, after the death of Solomon, excuse me. At the time of the division of the two nations. And the nation of Israel, those millions of people down through history, have never recovered because of casting aside God's annual festival season of tabernacles. He told them it was too far for them to go, but actually the city that he established one of the calves in which they did this worship in verse 29 was Bethel, just simply meaning the house of God, as it was to be called. And that's what, something like 20 or 25 miles from the city of Jerusalem? So it really wasn't too much more to simply go on down to Jerusalem and keep the feast as they should. But this thing in verse 30 became a sin. Not just a sin, it became a national tragedy. It became a national sin that was to affect the lives, the futures, the destiny, even the captivity and the disappearance of millions of people for all time, since then until now. So it became a tremendous tragedy. And he made a house of the high places and priests of the lowest of the people. And notice in verse 32, he ordained a feast in the eighth month. Now, it doesn't mention tabernacles here, but it's like unto the feast on the 15th day of the seventh month. Now, what did we just see that was? Well, this is the Feast of Tabernacles that he's talking about. In other words, he made a counterfeit Feast of Tabernacles 1 month later, and they observed it in the city of Bethel to replace God's Feast of Tabernacles in the seventh month, when they were to come to the city of Jerusalem. And so in verse 33, he offered upon the altar which he had made in Bethel the 15th day of the eighth month, even the month which he had devised of his own heart. Now it shows many, many significant lessons here throughout just these few verses. But no one ever commits suicide, other than perhaps some deranged individual, someone who is mentally upset. But people are not out to commit suicide. They're not out to bring death and destruction and pestilence, disease, captivity upon themselves or upon future generations of their own families. They didn't do this purposefully to create trouble for themselves. But they began to look at the problems and the difficulties around them rather than trusting exclusively in God and faithfully obeying, and the result is tragic. And we suddenly then are plunged into what becomes one of the most dynamic periods in the history of the Bible, in the history of mankind. There's no other period quite like it as far as dealing with the future of the entire nation of Israel and eventually the future of the nation of Judah. But from this point on, from this decision on in chapter 12 of 1 Kings, there, after that period of time, is not one single righteous king in the entire nation. God sends prophet after prophet. He begins with the prophet Hosea, or Elijah and Elisha if you go back even further. But as far as the books in the Bible that we have, he begins with Hosea and Joel and Amos and Micah. He sends Isaiah. A little later on to the nation of Judah, he sent Jeremiah. And they never hearkened to a single one of those prophets of God, men whom we look back upon with respect and a little bit of awe, whom we consider to be absolutely the bona fide servants of God in history. And so for a period of about 500 years, God sends prophet after prophet, servant after servant. They speak to these people. They put what they have in writing, encouraging them to keep God's holy days and God's feasts, obeying God to put the idols out of the land. But the nation of Israel never does it. Goes into captivity, even eventually losing their own identity. Not only did they lose the identity of the true God, they lost their own identity. And the nations of Israel scattered across the northern states of Europe, the British Isles, the United States and Canada today, to this day, over 2,500 years later, do not even know their own identity. And so God's church, apart from a few zealous Jews in the traditions of the Old Testament, are the only peoples keeping this Feast of Tabernacles this year with understanding on earth. The Feast of Tabernacles and God's feasts have never throughout history, even after God gave them to his people, been observed consistently over any period. Now here we are observing the 53rd Feast of Tabernacles in this era of God's church. 53 festivals of tabernacles observed exactly as God gives the commands and the instructions in the Bible. And that in itself is almost an unprecedented period of time in history. There were no faithful kings in Israel following this period of time. Not a one of them was righteous. They never observed the Feast of Tabernacles till they went into captivity, and the nation of Israel hasn't observed them to this day. Judah did on occasion. Occasionally there was a righteous king, maybe someone who started out right and perhaps didn't end up too well, or a Hezekiah or a Josiah. But you know, every time you find a restoration of God's truth in the Bible, what is always prominent? Sometimes they didn't even remove the idols out of the country. Sometimes they didn't remove the high places that were of pagan origin out of the nation. They may have done one thing or another, but every time there's a restoration of God's way in the Bible, every time from the day that these festivals were given, it always includes the Feast of Tabernacles or these festival seasons, either by name or perhaps simply identification of what they were doing on certain days of the seventh month or during the other festival periods, the spring and all in the year. There has never been a restoration of God's way. Think of the significance of that. There has never in all history been a restoration of the way of God on earth apart from these annual festivals which we're observing right now. And they were observed with, to one degree or another, with a progressive revelation. They were observed throughout history just as we're observing them now, with the prophets of God understanding basically, as I said, progressively revealed, so that we have it here today in this end age in the Bible. But with the same understanding, the same significance of these festivals as we understand now. And that's particularly true concerning this Feast of Tabernacles, which we're observing. But let's go back to pick up this story to the first chapter of Ezra. Now we're jumping ahead again a little bit rather quickly in history, and I'm just going to give you some general dates, not because they're necessarily important as to whether they're accurate to one year or another, but so you'll get a feeling of where we are in time. Israel is now in captivity. They've been gone for a long period of time, a couple of hundred years. The nation of Judah, following the death of Josiah, has gone into captivity. Jeremiah has already gone to Ireland, to the north, and effected the healing of the breach between the tribes of Pharez and Zara, which you read about in Mr. Armstrong's booklet on the United States and British Commonwealth and prophecy. Daniel has gone into captivity. Ezekiel has gone into captivity. And a number of years have passed, and we're down to now about 538 B.C., almost 70 years from the initial stages of the captivity of Judah and the destruction of Jerusalem. And God authorizes a restoration of his way, of his religion, back in the city of Jerusalem, which still lies desolate. The temple has been destroyed, the city has been burned or ravaged to the ground, and the walls still lay flat. A desolation reminiscent of the punishment then that God brought upon these people because of the transgressions of his laws and the rejection of his way. Well, now this is obviously a bona fide restoration in the history of Judah. Are we going to find them keeping these annual festivals? Is it even possible? Is it even possible for a restoration, a reestablishing of God's truth on earth apart from the annual holy days which God's given us? The answer is no. It's not. And perhaps the significance of God testing Mr. Armstrong from 1927 for 7 years in keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, the annual holy days, even though he was ridiculed and laughed at, virtually spurned for 7 years, just himself and his wife, is probably a whole lot more important than we might realize, because he proved at that time, as God was going to use him to restore his truth to this earth in the end of the age, he proved that Mr. Armstrong would be faithful to these annual holy days, because if we begin to veer away from God's annual holy days, we'll lose the identity of God. And we'll lose the knowledge and the understanding that God has given us as far as his plan. And we simply cast ourselves adrift to follow our own reasoning, our own ideas, which ultimately will lead inevitably to tragedy, as occurred with ancient King Jeroboam when he cast away the knowledge, the understanding of the festivals and substituted his own counterfeit feast. But this is a restoration, an important period in the history of the Bible, closing out this dynamic 500-year period, which is unique in history. But in verse 1 of chapter 1, in the year of first year of Cyrus, and again, as I said, that's probably about 538 B.C., the decree went out to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. In verse 2, he has charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem in Judah, which, of course, lies desolate at that point. In chapter 2, verse 1, Zerubbabel, and we'll see his name a little bit later, verses 1 and verse 2, left to go back about 535 B.C. with some 42 to maybe 50,000 people, including, as I said, porters and servants and others, a small group of people, comparatively, a whole lot smaller than we are keeping the Feast of Tabernacles this year. There are more people keeping the Feast of Tabernacles in the United States then went back for this restoration in the 500s B.C. Well, what was one of the first things they did? Let's notice chapter 3, verse 1. One of the first things they did when they got back to Jerusalem to carry out this commission of God, when the seventh month was come, that's this month that we're in now, that's the month that contains trumpets and atonement, tabernacles in the last great day. They gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem, just as we're gathered here, as one man in the Ozarks, as one man in the Dells, or the other festival sites that we have. And in verse 2, at the very end of the verse, they kept this festival as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. And in coming back in this restoration, you're going to find they were very particularly careful that they observed the feast exactly. And we find them during this period of time, as the Bible says, observing the festival so accurately and carefully as has not been done since the days of Joshua. That goes back beyond Jeroboam. It goes back beyond David. It goes back beyond the kings and the days of the judges to the entrance into the promised land from the Exodus. So this is a unique period of time, and we're observing the festival as far as what is applicable to us today. just as carefully as they did in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. And we're going to see some similarities not only in our services, which we have, but also in the message that was given concerning this feast. And so they kept the feast, verse 4, the Feast of Tabernacles in the seventh month, as it is. And in verse 6, from the first day of the seventh month, that's trumpets, just as we observed it this year. And the foundation of the temple, of course, it says in verse 6, was not yet laid. Well, let's jump ahead, and we're going to jump now through a period of time of difficulty and trouble, but you ought to read chapter 4 yourself, maybe during this feast, and you can maybe see even a little bit of a similarity between the adversaries that they faced in doing the work of God here, just as we face with the state of California, the receivership, and other persecution that sometimes even slows down or holds back or frustrates the work of God for a period of time. And they went through this period even after God had authorized and was obviously behind their rebuilding the temple and this restoration of God's way. They're going to lose 15 years here between chapters 3 and 4 and the last few verses of chapter 4 that just disappeared when no work was done. And so in chapter 5, verse 1, then the prophets Haggai and Zechariah prophesied unto the Jews and encouraged Zerubbabel again, verse 2, to get up and to get about building the temple. But you know, if you just read over this very quickly, you're not going to recognize the significance of this period of time when Haggai and Zechariah spoke. When was it that they encouraged these people, hundreds, well now, 2,000 years ago, or 2,500 years ago nearly, about the work, the restoration that was to be done? We're going to have to go to another section of the Bible. You may hold your place here because we'll eventually be back to Ezra and Nehemiah, but turn to the Minor Prophets, a section of the Bible that has taken a little bit of a bad rap because they're not minor in importance or significance at all. They're just simply shorter in length. But these individuals, called the minor prophets, or the men who have at least recorded shorter segments of their prophecies than Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, though some of them prophesied over a much longer period of time. The prophet Hosea may have prophesied 50 or 60 years. The prophecies of Ezekiel cover maybe 20 years. So they were not minor in importance or significance or in the eyes of God. The minor prophets actually began before Isaiah and encompassed this entire period of time from about 800 B.C. all the way down to 450. Encompass all of what are called the major prophets and this period of time in the history of Israel and Judah. So they're not minor from that point at all. And in the book of Haggai, let's notice where we are, verse 1. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month. So we're kind of in the late summer, early autumn again, aren't we? With the sixth month. That's when Haggai began to speak, when Zerubbabel was stirred up by those prophecies. Notice chapter 2. Chapter 2, where are we now? In the seventh month. The prophecy of Haggai is the shortest prophecy in the Bible that is recorded as far as a book. It took place over 3 months. Some of them spoke for 50, 60, 70 years. But Haggai's prophecy, the significance of what he did at this particular time in chapter 5, verse 1, took place over 3 months. And one of those months was the seventh month. So where are we again? Well, we'll have to look to see which day it's talking about. It's not the day of trumpets, the seventh month, the 1 20th day. It's not the day of atonement. It isn't the annual Sabbath beginning the Feast of Tabernacles, but it is during Tabernacles. And it's the very last day of Tabernacles, not the last great day, because that's a different subject than we're going to find included here. But the last day, which would be what? It would be Friday this week, Thursday night and Friday. Well, let's let's read a little bit more about what was said. In verse 2, he said, "Speak now to Zerubbabel." Obviously, we're talking about a type of meeting or service because of the people involved. He did not just go privately to Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest and speak, but he went to both of them and to the residue, that is, those people brought back in this restoration, to the residue of the people. And remember, we're during the Feast of Tabernacles, when they had meetings, when they kept God's holy days as they were written. And what we're going to find here are excerpts of a sermon during the Feast of Tabernacles nearly 2,500 years ago. God's recorded for us a sermon, a message given by the prophet Haggai about 2,500 years ago. Now, it's not all here. You don't know how long he spoke. You don't know whether he stayed within the time limit, let's say, that we normally have for sermons during the feast, or whether he really gave them a shot and maybe kept them there in the middle of the afternoon. It just doesn't say. And all we find are significant highlights, and it's so reminiscent of sermons that Mr. Armstrong has given, because it includes two basic things. It includes the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles and why they were there and what God is going to do in the future, and applied that in type during this restoration to the era in which they lived, and urged them to participate in God's work at that time. Now, how many times have we heard Mr. Armstrong at the festival, going back however long? Maybe some of you were back in the early days of Big Sandy in the middle 1950s. Others of you have heard Mr. Armstrong in these recent tapes last year and this year, and he'll talk about the meaning of the day, but he always includes our purpose, doesn't he? He always talks about the work. Now, is that some kind of business that we just do in this day and age, or have God's servants always done that during the holy days? And the answer is, they've always done it. It's not some gimmick in the 20th century, but it's been inspired by God at all times when his servants, the prophets, were at the festivals and speaking. And so we find the sermon beginning in verse 3. And he's speaking to them, and he says, "Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory?" Referring, of course, to the work that they were to do. Nothing virtually had been done. The foundation was laid at this point, but they hadn't gone any further. The city of Jerusalem still was desolate. They'd been there for over 15 years now. And so he's referring to the work that God sent them to do. "And who saw the temple in its first glory, and now how do you see it?" Well, Mr. Armstrong has admonished and urged us the same way. Look at the commission God's given us. We're nowhere near done. We're nowhere near finished. We've got to support the work financially, emotionally, spiritually, and through prayer and fasting, because there's much yet to be done. And so in verse 4 he said, "Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, the high priest. Be strong, all you people." Not only the ministers, the servants, the governors that God had placed there, but the whole people, the whole residue. Even in the keynote address, Mr. Armstrong talked about supporting him, but how important our responsibilities as individuals are. And if this Feast of Tabernacles is to be the greatest Feast of Tabernacles, or one of the greatest feasts in this era, perhaps one of the most important in all history, then it depends on what you as individuals do to make it so. It doesn't depend upon Mr. Armstrong. It doesn't depend upon the ministers at the various sites. They have their part to do. And Mr. Armstrong has done all he could in encouraging us to fast and to pray and to be here and to participate. But you've got to step out spiritually and make it important, and live and relive the meaning of this feast, and spend time on your knees in prayer, and be reading and studying various of the times when this festival was observed, whether it was Christ in the New Testament, beginning in the 7th chapter of John, through the last great day. There are about 3 or 4 chapters from John 7 through the 10th, perhaps into the 11th chapter, I forget now just what, where Christ kept his last Feast of Tabernacles and emphasized the importance of the last great day. Read those scriptures. Go back throughout history and read where the great feasts were kept and God's instructions concerning them, and get into the spirit and the feeling of this feast. So so that you can be stabilized and strengthened and hold fast to traditions, which all too many of people who had that opportunity and knowledge throughout history never did do. But Haggai did, and Zechariah did, and Zerubbabel responded, and they kept this feast, and it strengthened them, and they went out then and built the temple, and ultimately completed their responsibilities under Ezra and Nehemiah a short time after. So he said, be strong. And notice it mentions here, be strong, you people of the land, saith the Lord, and work. And we call it the work today, but very, very similar terminology, very reminiscent of the type of thing which Mr. Armstrong has done. Well, he's going to continue then expounding about the meaning and the understanding of this Feast of Tabernacles. You might ask yourself, where did Haggai get that knowledge? Because God has progressively revealed it from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob to the nations of Israel, and God's servants have, at least in part, those who have had God's Spirit and whom God was calling in this day and age, or in their day and age rather, have understood basic meanings and principles concerning these holy days. But where would a man like Haggai get it? Did he make it up out of whole cloth any more than Mr. Armstrong did? Well, the answer is no. But what we're going to see here is Haggai referring to men he looked to who had lived just prior to his time. Now, we look back on them hundreds of years. He's looking back 60, 70 years at a time. And on back into the book of Isaiah, a couple of hundred years. Not quite as far back, but he's looking to the same men and to what they wrote, and he even quotes from them, using the same terminology, the same words, about what's going to happen concerned during the millennium, which is pictured by this Feast of Tabernacles in this sermon. Let's notice real quickly just two or three verses that he uses here. And you can go back and look up in your margin a little bit later on as you study this sermon. The sermon runs down through verse 9. So we have six verses of a sermon some 2,500 years ago. And he says, well, let's see, let's start down in verse 6. For thus says the Lord of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land. That's exactly what's going to occur, ushering in the millennium. But hold your place here. You're holding your place in a lot of different spots in the Bible now. And let's turn back to Jeremiah, the 51st chapter, Jeremiah 51. We're going to see that he even uses the terminology that God's servants and prophets have used concerning these times. Jeremiah 51, and we'll just read verse 33. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, the daughter of Babylon is like a threshing floor. It is time to thresh her, referring to the destruction of Babylon and what it refers to on into the end of the age. Prophecies for a long time in the future as well concerning the end of this age. And notice he says, yet a little while. Yet a little while, and these things are going to occur relative to the destruction of Babylon and ushering in the millennium at the end of the age, even using the same words, the same kind of terminology. Over in Joel, another one of the minor prophets, as they're called, in the book of Joel, the third chapter, verse 16, the Lord shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake. Well, that's exactly what the prophet Haggai is saying. And Joel wrote before Haggai, back at the same time of Hosea and Amos, and a little bit before Micah, about the time or just before Isaiah, before Israel went captive. So we're looking back 200 to 300 years now. The same terminology, the same message, which Haggai then used, and which we find him paraphrasing, quoting, in this sermon on the 21st of the seventh month during the Feast of Tabernacles. And so he says, the heavens and earth shall shake, and the Lord will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. Let's go to verse 7. And I'll shake all nations, Haggai said, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I'll fill this house with glory. Well, is that referred to by any of the other prophets, or did Haggai make that up out of whole cloth? What he's talking about here is how to pay for, how to sponsor many of the developments and the growth and the rebuilding, the reestablishment in the millennium, providing food and clothing. Of course, the answer is yes. Turn back to Isaiah, the 23rd chapter, and we'll find a scripture here. Isaiah 23, verse 18. And her merchandise and her hire, referring to Babylon or Tyre, shall be holiness. In other words, God's going to consecrate that, confiscate it. And it shall not be treasured or laid up in the future. Her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before the Lord, even providing people to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. And then in the minor prophets again, you might just notice the book of Micah, again written about the time of Isaiah, in the fourth chapter. Micah, the fourth chapter, and let's just read verse 13. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I'll make you thine horn iron and your hoofs brass, and you shall beat in pieces many people. And then notice the end. And I'll consecrate, again confiscating, I'll consecrate the gain, the wealth of the earth at that time, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. So what we find back here in the book of Haggai on this 21st of the seventh month during the Feast of Tabernacles is a servant of God keeping very carefully, as we're doing in this day and in this era, the Feast of Tabernacles, and preaching about what? Actually, we could preach a whole sermon out of the second chapter of the book of Haggai and tie in Isaiah and Jeremiah and various of the minor prophets and go into the book of Revelation and refer to Daniel and give an entire sermon filling in what is obviously, what we have here, just obviously excerpts of. An entire sermon about the meaning of this Feast of Tabernacles, as well as the responsibility that they had and the responsibility that we have at this time to do God's work in this day and in this age. Let's go to one more scripture before we close, back in the book of Nehemiah. And Nehemiah just simply follows on after Ezra. The same commission, the same responsibility, completing the work that had been commissioned now nearly 100 years before. We're down now to about 444 B.C., and the first two-thirds of the book of Nehemiah take place in just a matter of days and a few months. But let's see what they begin to do in chapter 8 and starting in verse 1. And all the people gathered themselves together as one man in the street that was before the water gate. Whenever people are in a right attitude in serving God, you might notice it always refers to it that way, because they're giving their allegiance to God, to His law and to His way, and they're there with one mind. They're there as one man, regardless of how many they might be. How many are we talking about again? Well, they came back with 42,300 and some, I think it was. We're talking about, in size, a group much smaller than this Feast of Tabernacles this year. And they gathered unto Ezra, and Ezra spoke from the law of God. And in verse 2, notice, all that could hear with understanding were there when, upon the first day of the seventh month, that's trumpets again, just as we observed a few days ago. And notice, we're going to see here how closely our services today are patterned after what these people were observing again about 2,500 years ago. And he read therein before the street that was before the water gate, from the morning until midday. Well, now it's approaching midday here, and I've about run out of time. We're very, very careful about the length of services and not going way over, even during the holy days themselves. But these people were there from morning till midday, just as we are during the festivals. And those that could understand, the ears of all the people were attentive unto the book. Notice verse 4, and Ezra the scribe stood upon a pulpit of wood. We do exactly the same thing. We're not before the water gate, but we're in God's house at the Ozarks or St. Pete or wherever it may be designated. But it's the same kind of thing, standing up where people can see and hear. A pulpit of wood. In verse 5, Ezra opened the book in the sight of the people, for he was above all of them, so they could see him, and the people stood up. Now, do we ever stand up in our services? Surely we do. Notice verse 6, because Ezra was blessing God. Ezra was leading the congregation in prayer, the great God and all the people answered after he had blessed God with amen. And our services begin and end the same way exactly today. Lifted up their hands, they bowed their heads as Ezra blessed or prayed to God and worshiped the Lord with their faces to the ground. And we do exactly the same thing. And then they preach and cause the people to understand the law. Verse 8, so they read in the book of the law of God distinctly, or as that could be translated, with meaning or with interpretation, explaining what the significance of these days are. That's exactly what happens on every holy day. We always explain the meaning of what that day means, of what its significance is, and renew it and refresh it in our minds, live and relive it, and do it with interpretation. And they gave the sense and caused them to understand the reading. And then they continued on to the Feast of Tabernacles. Let's notice the last two verses. And all the congregation of them that came again out of the captivity made booths and sat under the booths, which had not been done for hundreds of years. Because it says here, for since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, unto that day, had they not been so careful in their observance of the festival to even sit under the booths in and around the city of Jerusalem. And there was very great gladness. Why? Well, because they were blessed by God and by God's Spirit being among them, because they were so carefully obeying him. And also day by day. Now, what do we do relative to the Feast of Tabernacles? Do we just have a service on the holy days and then we go our own separate ways? Our minds get off the purpose of this feast, off the reason why we're here? No. We have a service from morning until midday, every day of the festival, and two services on the holy days, on the Sabbaths. But these people kept the feast exactly the same way. In verse 18, day by day, from the first day into the last, he read into the book of the law of God, and they kept the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days. Notice how careful they are to make that distinction, even as Mr. Armstrong has been. And on the 8th day, that's the last great day, a solemn assembly was held according to the manner, in other words, according as God had commanded. Well, brethren, we have the same phenomenon in our day. We're living in a time of restoration. We're living in a time of persecution when there are adversaries. We're living in a time increasingly that is becoming unstable, that's beginning to touch every life and every family in the church. From the energy crunch to inflation to persecution and the difficulties that we all face, how can we remain stable? Historically, how does God show his people, the nation of Israel, the nation of Judah, God's servants, during any restoration, regardless of the opposition, remain stable? They always clung to God's annual Sabbaths, very carefully and very faithfully. Well, brethren, that festival, which was great in God's eyes, was kept by what originally began with 42 to 45,000 people. Now, we have more than that on earth today. Can we celebrate in God's eyes in this time of restoration, as Mr. Armstrong has admonished us, as great a Feast of Tabernacles, with as much joy, with great gladness and great rejoicing, and with an ever-deepening understanding of the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles, and even as importantly now, as Mr. Armstrong has said, the significance of these festivals to the worldwide Church of God? The answer is yes. But it's going to depend upon every one of us how much time we spend in prayer to God, how close we are, and how much we live and relive these services. The schedule's basically the same this year. Two services on each holy day, which are double Sabbaths this year, a service in the morning, activities in the afternoon. The schedule's basically the same. But the services themselves, the sermonettes, the sermons, the messages, the instruction, the giving of the sense, the reading with interpretation, that's new, that's live, that's filled with God's Spirit. And we've got to think of it that way and not just take some of these things for granted, but put our whole life into it. And if you strengthen yourself at this Feast of Tabernacles, you can be guaranteed If you continue with that same spirit, that same outlook with the benefits you receive, you can guarantee, you can know that you'll remain stable during the remainder of this year. No, brethren, let's take Paul's admonition concerning the times and the end of the age in which we live and be sure, not just physically and literally because we're here, but spiritually, that we hold fast the wonderful traditions and laws which God has given us right now, this Feast of Tabernacles.